All right. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Sand Hill Road. I have a very special guest today with me here. It's Dan Ahrens, who's a managing partner at Left Lane Capital, which is a growth capital firm focusing on consumer tech, fintech, edtech, and everything in between. But I don't want to take away too much of your thunder, Dan. Why don't you give us the highlights of who you are and what you've been up to in the last couple of years? Because just for the audience, Left Lane, it's a rather young firm, but they've achieved a tremendous amount in a very short period of time.
Yeah, thanks, Erasmus. It's great to be here and appreciate the kind introduction. So the idea for Left Lane really started in a very simple place, which was we saw the entirety of the investor world really flocking for one asset class in particular, that being enterprise software, where over the last 20 years, the vast majority of funds and of groups have been placing their investments. It's where a lot of their returns have come from, and for good reason, right? It's a great asset class. We started working together in different groups, the four partners, really about 7-8 years ago, right around when you started to see the rise of the app store, the rise of mobile-first platforms starting to take more and more of the economy, frankly, onto their rails and onto their backbone. And we said, we asked one question, which was, as you see this shift and this transformation start to happen, can you see all of the good things about enterprise software, long-term customer relationships, products that become a core part of their end customer's life? Can you see those characteristics in these usually mobile-first, digital-first, consumer SMB-focused utilities where, you know, these are the fundamental use cases for customers that we think they can have 8-10-year-long relationships? In other words, can we see what's great about software in the consumer internet space and ultimately build a practice around it? And the Left Lane is really just the realization of that idea and building out a consumer internet growth fund that's based on those principles and putting that strategy to work.
Consumer tech, a lot of people are sort of, you know, hesitant. I mean, there are firms like Greylock who built a name, a reputation around being sort of leaders in consumer tech. What's been, you know, your personal experience, you know, when also pitching it to LPs? As LPs, they like enterprise, they like predictable sort of business models, predictable routes to exits. And consumer tech has always been sort of even more power-lord distributed, I feel. What's your personal view on that?
Consumer tech is a very broad umbrella, and you're right on. If you look over the past 2 decades historically, you'll see phases and periods of time where, frankly, consumer technology was boom or bust, right? If you go back to the turn of the millennium and the dot-com boom or bust, that was really when consumers were interacting with the internet primarily for informational purposes, right? It was the beginnings of some of the early e-commerce sites, but it was mostly information at that point. Then you had what I'll call the social network boom or bust era where, put frankly, you know, you either won your demographic or didn't. And if you were the third best, fourth best version of LinkedIn, for example, ultimately it was going to be hard for you to gain traction. So that again was boom or bust. The tailwinds and thesis that we're investing behind, we think is pretty fundamentally different. And that's this idea that if you look at consumer spend in the Western world, it's a $30 trillion category. And it includes a wide variety of things. Some of these are one-time purchases, homes, mattresses, et cetera. But a number of these things are the types of things that consumers rely on day in, day out. Things like food delivery, where you educate your children, where you're able to actually get healthcare, how you build personal wealth, right? These are things that will always be a part of your life. And the tailwind that we're investing behind is the transition of these categories really into digital first companies. So instead of being the place where you go to find a healthcare provider, this is now the place where you receive the healthcare in many cases that you ultimately need. And so we view that as a much more stable opportunity, a much more resilient opportunity. And qualitatively, that's what we're focusing on and that's what we're investing in. Now, you're quite right. This was the number one question from a lot of LPs around how can you find consistently resilient businesses within the consumer tech space. And it starts with the concepts that make enterprise software as strong of an asset class as it is. It starts with retention. You know, we're only investing in companies where 5, 8, 10 years into a customer's relationship, they're still using the product. They're still paying for the product. You want, you know, enterprise software, highly scalable business model. We're looking for scalable business models. We're looking for businesses that have high growth margin today, not necessarily businesses where the unit economics will need to get better over time. So it's taking many of those fundamental principles and having a strong belief that now is a time, the past 5 years and the next several decades, is a time where these long-term operating system of the consumer use cases are going to be coming online, and that they have the characteristics you need to build consistent portfolio.
Love it. We went straight to the end, did a deep dive in consumer tech versus enterprise, but let's go all the way back. Then I think you went to Duke, and then that's sort of afterwards when you got your way into venture through consulting. Maybe just take us all the way back, then graduated from Duke. I was there for a couple of summers for a math camp, so I like the campus quite a bit. The Harvard of the South, as they call it, right? But take us back to the fresh graduate, Dan, and how you made your way into the wonderful world of venture.
Sure. I think we prefer to say that Harvard is the Duke of the North, but I'll forgive you on that front. So look, when I graduated Duke, I'll be honest, I didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I knew a couple of different things. I liked solving problems. I liked math. I liked working with people. I knew eventually that I wanted to start something, but I didn't know when that was going to be and when I would ultimately be able to get involved with that. So like a lot of people who look like that, I started my career in consulting. So I was over at Boston Consulting Group for a number of years, and I got lucky there in some ways. I got to work on really interesting digital transformation challenges and problems for mostly consumer-facing companies. And so working with Fortune 1000 businesses to help think through, how can we build digital customer relationships? How can we start to think through new ways of acquiring customers, new ways of engaging customers, the multi-channel problem, as we call our omni-channel problem. Absolutely great place to cut my teeth and to get started. I knew pretty early on in that process that eventually I wanted to work with the people that were enabling the transformation and building the types of companies that were driving this transformation. And so that's really how I found my way over into venture from there.
And 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I think you raised the maiden fund for Leftlane, which was a $630 million maiden fund. And I think it took 2,500 meetings of you and Harley Miller and the other founding members to get to that. And it is fiendishly hard to raise the first fund. I mean, there was quite a bit of tailwinds in the market. You know, a lot of people looked at your track record at your former firm, but maybe walk us a little bit through how raising a first-time fund felt like 2 or 3 years ago when you started out going on your own.
It was hard. There's no denying it. I think few things have helped generate a greater sense of empathy with the founders that we work with than the four of us getting on the road, flying around the country before the pandemic shut things down, pitching our vision, which was a deck where we didn't even have the Leftlane name yet. And we're using various placeholders. And then importantly, getting told no over and over and over again. But I think the biggest thing for us was in raising a first time fund was really focusing on what our differentiation is. I think if you look back, you know, starting that process in 2019, 2020, there was a massive influx of new managers coming to market for the first time and an influx and an acceleration of pace for all the managers who had already raised large funds coming back to market. And so for us, the messaging and the effort was really a lot around where do we feel like we have an edge, right? And so it really started with that internet consumer focus and specialization and having dedicated a lot of our careers in one way or another to this exact asset class, an asset class that we ultimately felt was new, and being able to demonstrate that understanding and that differentiation across every single step of the value chain of investing for us, right? So because all we were looking at was internet consumer SMB, that would make us source better. We felt like our sourcing was differentiated for a variety of reasons. That would help us understand how to diligence these companies and select companies better, because this was all that we looked at. We weren't generalists who also had a mostly SaaS function or SaaS practice that we had one consumer internet firm. This was the entire DNA of what we were doing. And then importantly, it would help us work with companies better and ultimately add value, because our network was very purpose-built and dedicated towards that internet and consumer space, so that we knew once we got things up and running, if a founder in our portfolio had questions, we had a really deep network of people who had gone on this scaling journey, and it was a very particular one, right, as an internet and consumer company. And so the fundraising process for us was really a matter of taking that messaging, getting that messaging correct, and then having the conversation that you mentioned 2,500 times to a lot of people who said no, And a few folks that were really grateful said yes, and ultimately helped get us into business.
And I think you started doing already quite a number of deals after sort of a first dry close, right? And that makes it even more difficult. I mean, it makes it easier and does change your pitch over time if you have a first portfolio and a fund and people are doing a late primary versus a totally blind pool.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to start, you know, executing deals while still talking to LPs, right? How did that change sort of your pitch as you went from the first close, dry close to the final close?
So I think the great thing about our pitch over time is it actually really hasn't changed, which I think is the sign that you're doing what you said you were going to do and that you're still continuing to be confident in where you can ultimately go with it. So for us, the journey was really at the beginning of the process, hey, here's what we say we're going to do. Here are the characteristics that we value very highly in businesses, right? That high retention, long-term customer relationships, highly trusted use cases, scalable business models, and that we can evaluate it. And here's our process. So our pitch only got stronger when we, you know, we closed our first two deals out of Fund One, which were GoStudent out of Vienna, Austria, the online education and tutoring marketplace, and M1 Finance out of Chicago, the long-term investment platform that centrally evolved into more of a financial super app. So once we did those two deals and they got off to great starts and have had really wonderful journeys so far, we were able to then say, here's what we say we're going to do or said we were going to do. By the way, we've already done it multiple times. It's off to a great start. And I think having that incremental credibility to show that it's not just theoretical on slides, but that we actually have real world examples of it happening, that really increased conversion and ultimately made things, I think, much more productive for us. And that journey only continued, right? I think we're now, let's see, a little over 3 years in, 3.5 years into our work here at LeftLane. And the message is still the same. Here's what we said we're going to do. For the vast majority, most part, we've done it. And we continue to be optimistic about where things are headed.
And talk a little bit about the famous LeftLane playbook and secret sauce in a sense. I think you mentioned it a little bit that you're really focusing on high retention, that you're very unit economics focused. I talked to a founder who was raising from you, and he told me that basically when you diligence them, helping them raise the next round already, you're an early growth investor. You sometimes lead also Series A's. I would say you're sort of your sweet spot from the outside. It seems like early Series B, but he was saying that basically you're preparing, when you look at the cohorts and the retention rates, you're preparing already the next round in a sense. And you know what investors in the next round are looking for. The Thomas Bravos, the NEAs of this world. Talk a little bit about this secret sauce or that playbook that you've developed over the last couple of years.
I think a lot of it hinges on one very simple but very powerful concept. And that is that consumer internet investing at the stage where we do it, which is really right after product market fit, all the way up through Series C, right? I'd say is sort of our sweet spot. Consumer internet businesses and SMB internet businesses at that stage have a massive amount of data available to them. Where let's say you are a $5 million revenue run rate consumer business, you may have tens of thousands of customers, right? When we invested in M1 Finance for their $28 million Series B, for example, they already had 100,000 plus users on the platform. That data is incredibly powerful in terms of how predictive it can ultimately be. With that information, if you're looking at it the right way and evaluating it the right way, you know, do customers love this product? Do they like this product? How have they used it? Have they made the decision to keep voting with their wallets to ultimately come back, or have they churned, right? How efficiently were you able to acquire them? So even though that's at a revenue stage, that feels much more like venture capital, right? You have all of the data availability of a growth equity story because you have a very high end of points telling you that this business is ready to keep doing the same thing that they're doing and grow very fast, or they're not. And I think if you contrast that with enterprise software again for a moment, at the $5 million stage, that might be 50 customers. That might be 15 customers, depending on what the ACVs ultimately are. And it's much more difficult to take that data and do some of the analysis and do some of the predictive work. So in our evaluation and diligent process, which we do view as the beginning of our relationship with every entrepreneur, we start just by simply asking for the raw data. We don't ask people to do a whole bunch of analysis. We say, look, just share your raw transaction file with us. We'll do all of the work on our end. And whether or not we invest, we'll play it to you and give you a sense of how we look at things and then also how that stacks up compared to other businesses that we've seen. Because very early on in the days of LeftLane, something that we heard a lot from NORS was no one's really looking at things this way. They would take a consumer internet business and apply enterprise software metrics to it, right? And benchmarks to it, which isn't necessarily the right way to do it. So we found from the beginning that this exercise was, yes, helpful for us, clearly, but then also that if we did it the right way and were collaborative about it, that it could also hopefully add a lot of value to the companies that we were ultimately diligencing. And so from the beginning, that the core tenet of what we do, and that ties through the entirety of the team. So everyone on our investment team is able to go from that first conversation where hopefully they're earning the right to build a relationship with the entrepreneur, all the way through analyzing sometimes millions of rows of raw data to ultimately get to that work product and get to the answer of, hey, should we invest? And whether yes or no, here's what we're seeing and hopefully it's helpful.
And founders in the last 2 years, they've been operating on an accelerated timeline in terms of fundraising. So I would expect there has been quite a lot of pushback when it comes to diligencing to the level of granularity that you're doing. A lot of the crossover funds are known to do a lot of outside in work. Tiger Global relying fully on the outside in work of a Bain consulting. As we speak, the FTX situation is unfolding and a lot of people are asking questions around due diligence these days. How has been the reception from the entrepreneurs in terms of diligencing their data and going into due diligence? I can imagine that there has been also some pushback when you tried to diligence some of this data, right?
I think it's really about the relationship you're able to develop with the entrepreneurs and presenting yourselves very clearly as experts and specialists and focused on this space from the first interaction that they ultimately have with the team, no matter who it is. So I think it's a matter of that, and it's a matter of framing the conversation appropriately and saying, look, from the beginning in the first call, removing some of the opacity that typically will accompany a VC diligence process and saying, here's step one, here's step two. This is ultimately what we're going to do. We are going to share this back with you regardless. And frankly, a lot of times founders have responded much more favorably to that and positively. And just as happened with you, I think if you go reference the founders that we've worked with or founders that we've diligenced, overall, our founder NPS is great. And I think this is a reason why, right?
It makes a ton of sense. I mean, it's a real value add whether you proceed with the round or not. And talking a little bit about scaling up your organization. And I mean, I think the first time I read about LeftLane, you didn't have a website yet, but I read in a Manhattan or New York real estate agency blog that you were leasing the offices that you're currently in, I think in Brooklyn. I think that preceded the website itself. And you've grown from, you know, a tiny organization, basically a four-person founder team, to now a pretty sizable organization. You've raised and announced the second fund, LeftLane 2. I think it was back in April at a $1.4 billion in commitments. So quite a sizable program that you're running. Talk a little bit about scaling it up and how that journey has been from your end as you've been in the midst of it over the last 2 years.
That first website was rough. I think for the first year of our existence, our website was, it looked like you were heading into a highway tunnel and you didn't know if there was light on the other end or not. I think in fact, we probably should have chosen some different creative for the background of our website. But no, it's been a great journey so far. I think from the beginning, all of our ambition was to build an institution, right? And to ultimately scale LeftLane into something that would outlast the four managing partners and outlast, hopefully, the team that we're ultimately building. We knew that in order to do that, we needed to scale the team. And we also knew that we wanted to have a promote from within culture. And so that people would begin their careers with LeftLane, they would identify, hopefully, that we were the best possible place for them to ultimately scale as investors and as leaders. And then importantly, give them the infrastructure and the tools that and the space that they needed to grow and ultimately develop into full stack investment partners with us over a period of time. And I think as you think about starting a fund and what was different between from being an investor or being a group of people who were doing deals at one fund to people who are in charge of really the entirety of the operation, that was one of the biggest areas that consciously we knew that we needed to invest in. And so I think before we even had, you know, 10 people, we already had the frameworks of how are we doing performance evaluations? How are we doing people management and development management? How are we making sure that the team get the feedback that they ultimately need to help scale? And then importantly, how do we enable the team and give them the platform that they need to quickly establish themselves as experts, to build strong, independent relationships with founders and demonstrate that they really do deserve to be, and that Left Lane deserves to be part of this journey to ultimately build it out. So from the very beginning of our practice, that was something I think you can probably find if you go back to some of the pitch decks that we had before we even had the Left Lane name. And so that's something that we've been super conscientious about. And then it's been a journey from there. I think each of us wanted to build a business and have a lot of that entrepreneurial blood. And so it's been a great journey coming here and having a chance to build this out.
And talk a little bit about deployment pace and portfolio construction. I mean, it was, especially on this early growth side, it was quite an interesting past 2 years with, you know, a lot of growth funds have, you know, moved from the 3-year investment period down to 1 year, 5 rounds announced every day, it almost felt like, and now it's calmed down quite a bit. How have you thought about, you know, also compressing sort of the investment period? Are you saying we're going to move with the market and slow down our investment period? Or are you also for the new fund keeping up the existing deployment pace?
Sure. So pace across the industry went historically fast in 2020 and in 2021. I don't think that's exactly news to anybody that's listening here. I think for us, what we've really tried to do is adhere to our target return curve and adhere to the principles of diversification, right? I think if you look at the playbook that we've been employing, which really is that growth equity style goals in terms of return curve, especially on the downside, but then ultimately playing for venture style upside, that looks like core check sizes and average positions that'll be in the tens of millions of dollars. That looks like some tens of positions right across the first across a different fund vintage. I think in our first fund, we have about 30 companies, for example, for the $630 million fund one. And so for us, it's been really trying, keeping the bar high, maintaining consistency in what we're ultimately looking for, and ensuring that we have enough diversification of positions and across vintages so that we don't get so concentrated within one period of time. So naturally, that, you know, that could look like slowing down over time, but it really is, are we hitting the bar? Are we not hitting the bar?
And in terms of, you know, growth rounds in general, speaking more about the market environment, I mean, you have more time for due diligence now. You have probably fewer competition. A couple of crossovers have dropped out altogether. Where's sort of the core of your focus now? Is it on the existing portfolio? Is it on still sourcing new opportunities? Let's say if a company is hitting this below 12-month run rate that you're thinking about, or start thinking about doing a bridge round. That's at least what I hear from a lot of growth funds, that they try to make sure that there's enough runway, that the budgets and the business plans are maybe a little bit scaled down, not assuming that the next 300 million round is raised overnight. Where's sort of the center of your attention, would you say, as a firm currently?
Yeah, it's all of the above, as it always is. I think with our, the bottom line is that there's just less capital available, particularly at the growth stages right now. And so with our portfolio, it's exactly as you said, it's figuring out how can we extend runway? How do we make sure that our plans are as close to fully funded as they possibly can be? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean in a number of cases, instantly rushing towards profitability at the expense of growth. I think you need to take each company on a case-by-case basis to figure out which strategy ultimately makes sense. Because the flip side of an environment where capitalism is available is that competition on the innovation front also drops exponentially, where more established enterprises will pull out of that new product initiative. Even some of the, you know, what we think of or thought of as startups 5-6 years ago that have raised hundreds of millions of dollars, they're much less likely to ultimately enter an adjacency and get competitive. And so while you need to be mindful, and we work with our portfolio on being mindful of that cash runway, it's also an incredible opportunity if you are able to efficiently innovate, get product two, maybe not products 2, 3, 4, and 5 all at the same time, but product two to market and develop there, that will actually lead to great deal more enterprise value over the next 3-4 years than simply rushing to profitability now at the expense of growth. So it's attention. It's where we've spent a lot of our time, just about as a number of peers in the industry have over the past year. And it's been a really full team effort.
You still have a relatively young portfolio that I assume is still well funded. But have there been, or maybe it's not even in your portfolio, but have there been instances where you saw the potential of a down round, potential of, you know, adding quite a bit of structure in terms of liquidity preference? What's the best way for a growth investor at this stage to talk to the portfolio companies? You know, these are hard conversations from, you know, the 2020, 2021 conversations, which were all about expansion and about, you know, Temasek coming into the Series D. These are now much more severe potential layoffs as part of adjusting the business plan. What's the right way of talking to entrepreneurs in this environment?
They are difficult conversations. And I think it starts with one, first, hopefully trusted relationships. I think it's a lot easier to have difficult conversations when along good times and bad so far, you've been on the phone at 6 a.m. one person's time and midnight the other person's time, depending on where you ultimately are, to build that relationship and have a lot of trust. I think on the topic of down rounds, structure, looking across the markets, not just speaking about Left Lane's portfolio, but across the market, I'd be surprised if you don't start to see it more. It's a natural effect of supply and demand of equity capital ultimately shifting on you. I think because so much capital was deployed and that pace has really only started to slow down in Q3 and then likely into Q4 here, I think it will take a little bit of time before you start to see very aggressive down rounds, structured rounds ultimately take hold. And the question becomes, for those companies that raised a good amount of capital, how do you use the capital that you have to ultimately get to financial independence so that when it comes time for that next equity raise, you're in a position of strength rather than in a position of weakness? And so I think a lot of the conversations with companies have been around that ugly reality that you laid out of, this is what it looks like if we ultimately, you know, if you need to go get more capital, and then how do you plan with the resources we have to try to avoid some of that?
And within the partnership, I mean, you broadly focus on consumer internet, but as we said, this goes into all different verticals from consumer fintech, from healthcare, from ed tech. What's sort of your vertical where you're spending most of your time?
Sure. So we don't have set verticals necessarily across each of us. I spent a lot of my time in fintech. I spent a lot of my time in logistics and overall commerce enablement.
And on the fintech side, maybe talk us through what you're seeing there or what you're most excited about most recently.
Sure. So a major thesis we're spending a lot of time on is this idea that capital availability for everybody in the ecosystem, not just companies, but also consumers, is starting to deteriorate and that it's going to be a really rough market over the next 18 to 24 months for people who are in need of capital. And so we've been spending a lot of time around that thesis and trying to find ways to, and companies that are helping solve some of these problems. So a company, for example, that we announced a Series A in over the summer is a business called ARC Technologies based in San Francisco. And ARC is really the future of startups, and I think it's in our opinion. Their first product is a revenue-based financing solution. So working primarily with B2B businesses, integrating into a variety of different data sources to get to a differentiated ability to underwrite and to evaluate risk, and then providing them with non-dilutive financing in order to help extend capital runway. Again, getting back to this idea of capital not necessarily being available, particularly in situations where equity financing might be too expensive or might not necessarily be an option. And this is step one for them. They've also launched ARC Treasury, which is a digital online treasury product that eventually, obviously, all of these different tools and features will work together really nicely. And as you think about that thesis, there's a couple of components to it. First, value existing where value previously wasn't necessarily recognized, where ARC has a differentiated ability to, with all of those different data sources and in an asset light, very tech focused way, underwrite and understand where a company is and how it's going to perform. And then also, you know, it's created a financial product that actually gives their end customers credit for that in order to be able to help them extract some financial value out of it and get the capital they need to ultimately continue the runway, right?
And there you led the Series A, if I understand correct, a couple of months ago, right?
Yes.
And just from my own knowledge of that segment or space, revenue-based financing, I heard a lot or read a lot in the last few years about Hype. They're in a similar segment. And I think there are two elements to it. First of all, it's getting this deal flow of companies, startups who have this need of revenue-based financing, then having obviously a credit facility. What's sort of the unfair advantage of ARK, would you say, when you looked at that opportunity in terms of competing with incumbents?
Sure. I think the first is that understanding of customers and having an orientation truly around credit management and being a credit company first and having an appropriate understanding of that through better onboarding, leading to better information about their customers and clients, and ultimately being able to come to market with, frankly, a better financial product. The second was overall the team and the vision. I think incredibly highly of Don, the CEO there, and the team that they've ultimately put together, and feeling like their roadmap was ultimately the right way to take this business model, which is looking at the future of startup finance and not just being the place where you're able to extend runway, but that combined with, you know, where you have a great world-class treasury product and a number of other products that are ultimately on their roadmap. We felt like that was differentiated and that they were in a real place of strength in the market.
There used to be venture debt for a couple of decades already and Silicon Valley Bank being sort of a prime provider, but that, at least in my understanding, focused more on real assets. Let's say a Docker that needs to build a cloud infrastructure, or some of the cloud players who really have to build server infrastructure and having hard assets to collateralize against these credits. But ARK is really based on SaaS revenue or consumer internet revenue, if I understand correctly, right?
Well, it's holistically underwriting the business. And for software businesses, absolutely. You have, going back to one of the reasons why SaaS has been a very invested in asset class, you have very good visibility into revenue from these guaranteed contracts that you're able to use to holistically underwrite the company with a really good degree of predictability, ultimately. And so it's leaning into that unfair advantage of the asset class and using data and information in a differentiated way to make sure that they're on the cutting edge of understanding precisely what's happening and what they're focused on and how the company is doing.
Yeah, but it's certainly the timing is right for a product like this. And then moving on to another portfolio company that you recently supported, which is EXO. And maybe talk a little bit about that, how that round came together and sort of what you were thinking around it was and your vision for the company there.
The thesis behind EXO Freight was relatively straightforward, and that is that flatbed open deck trucking here in the U.S. is an absolutely enormous market, $130, $150 billion opportunity, depending on what you look at. But when we spoke to other people in the industry, it was also an opportunity that was, frankly, undercovered, underinvested, and underappreciated by some of the very large freight brokerages and digital freight brokerages that we had seen. So we saw, as with any good marketplace opportunity, if you can build extremely strong relationships on the supply side of this industry and become the trusted partner for open deck and flatbed carriers, that you could ultimately build a really strong brokerage and marketplace business. It's also, as in many instances in logistics, it is pencil and paper today in terms of how things ultimately get booked. You'll have a trucker or a carrier checking the load board, calling in, sending an email, sometimes faxing things in still. So very much offline. And so we saw with the EXO Freight team, fantastic technology DNA within the business and an opportunity to digitize good portions of the freight brokerage, have the best relationships possible in the industry with carriers, the folks who actually the owner operators of the fleets of the open deck shippers or of the open deck carriers. And then a chance, once you build really strong relationships there, an interesting opportunity for a number of platform plays down the line. I don't think in this age you can separate fintech from the idea of B2B marketplaces. And getting back to that thesis that I was talking about earlier, just simply capital availability in a space where you are providing or working with companies where there's a lot of value ultimately being created there, there's also a good chance to ease working capital needs and cash flow needs and slowly start to expand the product out.
Yeah, the logistics segment has been on fire in recent years. I remember back in 2017, I had beers the night when Ryan Peterson of Lexport raised his Series B or announced his Series B. by chance, he was giving a talk at Berkeley. I was going for beers with him afterwards. And since then, this space has really exploded. I talked to Stuart, who's doing the 3PL operating system of warehousing and storage space. Where does EXO fit into this sort of broader ecosystem or Cambrian explosion, if you like, in the logistics segment?
So for them, it's really a couple of things. I think you laid out the context there very well, where two things have happened within logistics that you ultimately need to start seeing broad scale digital transformation. First, you had pioneer companies begin to bring elements of the business online so that some of the digitalization wasn't quite as foreign to people and began to build the base infrastructure on which some of these new logistics providers can ultimately operate. The second thing that's happened that's required for the type of transformation is there was a fundamental market shift where the entire system, as is very well documented, got thrown off by different supply and demand imbalances, different parts of different supply chain ecosystem, such that supply became very difficult to come by and people had to think about doing things a different way. And so we saw those two tailwinds, the beginnings of the digital infrastructure, and then this fundamental shift in the supply-demand imbalance is an opportunity for what we think is a trend that will continue over the next decade, which is digitalization of all things freight and logistics. And with EXO, where they fit into all of that was a particular use case in that what's effectively a marketplace. It's a digital freight brokerage, which looks a lot like a managed marketplace with supply being the open bed trucks that people weren't paying nearly as much attention to and that were all highly fragmented and long tail. So all of the classic dynamics that lead to a really good B2B marketplace, along with tailwinds and adoption tailwinds from all of those factors that I laid out earlier. And so we thought that it would be a great way to build a defensible business in this space and one that over time can command really strong economics.
Yeah, super exciting also that you're fairly early there in the journey. And I think it has a lot of room to grow and a lot of white space to capture there, this company. But maybe as we're running against the clock and as we're getting to the hour, talk a little bit about where people can follow your journey, Left Lane's journey. When is the right point in time when founders should reach out? Should they reach out? Are you reaching out to them? Are you doing any events in New York? And generally your call to action.
Our team should hopefully be trying to find you if you're an internet SMB, consumer entrepreneur, who's building something. So hopefully you have an email or an introduction to a member of the Left Lane team in your inbox. So first call to action, check and respond. I'd say beyond that, can always find us on any of the social media platforms at leftlanecap.com. Our most recent event was our Fast Growth Summit at our office opening in London, which was overall a great event. There will be more to come from the Fast Growth Summit series in the future. So looking forward to seeing folks out there.
Yeah, it's Magnus, right, who's leading the London office. Almost immediately when you launched, you had a London office there with Magnus. Talk a little bit, maybe as a last point, how you think about European tech as it's been sort of 10 years in the making and it's just blossoming. And as I understand, Left Lane is having a firm stance there. We talked about GoTo Students. We talked about Yokoi. You have quite a number of bets in Europe, which is not the typical thing you would think of a Brooklyn-based emerging manager, right?
The great thing about internet consumer businesses is because of how scalable the model is, you can build generational companies from anywhere, right? And Europe absolutely being no exception. And prior even to starting Left Lane, the team here had a number of great relationships with pioneering seed funds and companies in the European tech ecosystem. So frankly, we view that as part of our moat and something that we will always continue to double down in. If there is a need for consumers in the US, if something digitizes, you're ultimately going to see very similar things across the 700 million people in an enormous economy that Europe represents. So we will continue to ultimately double down there. We view ourselves very much as the US and Europe being a core part of our strategy and core geographies for us. And at the end of the day, if someone's building something interesting, part of our culture is you go get on a plane and you go see it. You know, after my partner Vinny's wedding, for example, one of my colleagues and I knew that there was an interesting business that was raping in Germany. And so his wedding was in San Diego. It was on Saturday night. Sunday morning, we were on the first flight we could possibly get to a small town in Germany to go get in front of this entrepreneur and meet this company. And I think that's the way that you can ultimately cover Europe and build really strong, lasting relationships there, despite our headquarters being in Brooklyn. And we look forward to our new office in London, great team that we have over there, and continuing to build out that presence.
That's great to hear as a European. And I mean, obviously, we had BeReal now coming out of France, out of nowhere, the next sort of social network. And now Saturday Night Live is doing a skit on them. And who would have thought that a Paris-based social media company can take the world by storm like this? But this is exactly what you're talking about.
There are consumers everywhere.
Exactly. So Dan, thanks so much for being here on the show. And continued success. I will monitor your journey going forward. I think it's quite interesting what you're building there and really achieved so much in so little time. And yeah, continued success to you and the whole team.
Thanks for asking. It's a pleasure. Yeah.